Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ben Freeman, director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, joins me to discuss Saudi Arabia's latest tactic when it comes to lobbying the U.S. government, taking its lobbying operation from Washington, D.C. to Middle America.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest stories of the week like she does every week. Hey, are you a member of the Ring of Fire radio podcast as of yet? Well, if not, you should hear what you're missing. Today on the program, an interview that I did with Ryan Liebenthal. She's writing about the history of student debt in this country. Fascinating and not as old of a story as you might imagine. In fact, that's a big part of the problem. This debt is not only enormous, but it's fairly recent. So if you're a member of the Ring of Fire radio podcast, you can hear that bonus material. Just head over to ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you can look back over the past, month or two that we've been doing extra content since the beginning of COVID. Check that out. We're going to be doing a lot more going in the future. It is your support that makes this possible. ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, a sneakily rather interesting and news-packed week when it comes to politics, and I should also say COVID as well, because so much of our response to COVID has to do with politics and the role that we see of government, and also the response that we have to the rest of the world having COVID. I mean, this is an aside, but I hope people understand that, what we saw in the difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration in terms of just even the rollout of the vaccine and the entire approach to it. Never mind the Biden administration finally under political pressure agreeing to, at the very least, the approach to the WTO and waive the patent for the COVID vaccine and the technology around it so that the rest of the world can use it and speed vaccinations up to their citizens. COVID is a sort of a low-hanging fruit illustration of just how much of what we experience in our daily lives is a decision. It is, we often hear politics talked about as if, it is a science or it's math exclusively. But at the heart of all of the things that we do in this country, whether it's providing unemployment support for people, whether it's providing them health care that is free at the point of service, and how we go about doing all of these things are decisions that we make as a body politic. And far too often they're presented as there are these constraints out there. And, here's a dirty little secret, folks. Those constraints are largely made up. It is really just a question of what our decisions are as a society. What do we value? Do we value some people having extraordinary wealth, or even, maybe a little greater size of people having tremendous wealth relative to the rest of the country, as opposed to extraordinarily tremendous wealth versus, people having, everybody having health care. I mean, that's just a decision that we make as a country and as a society, and people should be aware of that. But I digress. Let's talk about before we get to the Democrats and the decisions they're making, let's talk about the Republicans and the decisions they're making and what is implicating them. We're seeing something fascinating happen in the House of Representatives, and that is the Republican Party and the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives essentially eating Liz Cheney for lunch or for breakfast. She's number three most powerful House representative in the House, and not just like a there's a whole edifice behind her. She's not just some random person who managed to get there to the third position. She represents a significant portion of the Republican Party, maybe a diminished one. And they are eating her. And, you know, before we discuss this, let me just be quite upfront with my bias here. They are eating her. I am happy about that. And I hope that they choke on her bones. I don't mean to be graphic about this. I'm obviously speaking metaphorically. But as far as I'm concerned, I hope that they do eat her and devour her. And I hope that she poisons them and they all, you know, get ill. So, you know, again, metaphorically. But what do you make of this?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there are two sides to this. One is they're eating their own. They're, you know, in this civil war. It's Republicans in disarray, all of which is true. I mean, what's playing out is that the Republicans are now completely post-ideological. They don't have an ideology. Lynn Cheney has an ideology. You and I are horrified by her ideology. And it really is one of the worst. I mean, this is a woman who, you know, she's talking about democracy and all this terrific. I mean, I don't disagree with anything she's saying about January 6th or the election or Donald Trump. But, you know, she's also a proponent of torture who agrees with her father that it's a no-brainer to torture people. So how different is she from Donald Trump, really? Because he likes torture, too. I mean, this is, you know, on the ideological level, Liz Cheney is as far right as you can get, really, in terms of the real sort of intellectual ideology of what we used to think of as the right wing of the Republican Party. She's a, you know, Donald Trump isn't wrong when he says she's a warmonger. She is. But they're purging her, and they're going to replace her with somebody who actually voted with Donald Trump way less than she did, who has zero principles as far as we can tell. I'm talking about Congresswoman Elise Stefanik from New York, who is poised to do it. And her main claim to the job is that she is a very, very energetic Trump sycophant. And that's really what it takes. And she has promoted the big lie. So they have that. And there is a sense that they don't, you know, who are these people now? What are they beyond just sort of a Donald Trump cult? What are they? But there's another side to this, Sam. And that is that, in fact, you know, I think it's worth thinking about that these people are getting what they want. You know, it's not, everybody talks about them like they're cowards. You know, oh, poor Kevin McCarthy, he tried to do the right thing in that 5 minutes on January 6th, and then he couldn't because all the people who love Trump came after him and Trump got mad and blah, blah, blah. Over and over and over again, we hear this tale of these Republicans who really, you know, if only they just had a little more freedom, but Donald Trump just won't let it happen and their voters are rabid, you know, Trumpers. You know, I don't believe that for a minute. I think they're getting what they want. I mean, what's happening is that they're no longer bound by ideology. They are now in a pure pursuit of power political game. And it's not just Trump and it's not just the House. Look at what Mitch McConnell said this week. His number one focus is to block Biden's agenda. I mean, he's not talking about trying to do anything. All this hocus pocus about bipartisanship is all bunk, of course. And so these people are, it's about a pursuit of power for its own sake. And, you know, there's this authoritarian streak, the white nationalism, the racism, this whole kind of, you know, bizarre mishmash of, you know, they aren't even ideas of just impulses that they have. But, you know, all of this is really working in the Republicans' favor. Now, if they can achieve what they are setting out to achieve right now, which is restrict the vote in the Electoral College and restrict the vote in the Senate. And they're going to gerrymander the hell out of their states, too, and add some seats. You know, they are in a position to maybe cement this idea that they have minority. You know, they are a minority that will be able to exercise full power of the government. And of course, that's what they want. I mean, and they don't even mind embarrassing themselves by, you know, just prostrating themselves at the feet of Donald Trump, because that's what it takes. That's what the people want. And that's fine. And you know, you said about Liz Cheney, they're going to eat her for lunch or dinner or whatever. I mean, she's a human sacrifice to this cult. And it's fine with them. I mean, they don't have to do this. She can say what she wants. They don't have to listen to her. They can just say, "Oh, Liz, she's crazy." I mean, they do it with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They do it with all the rest of these people. They could just dismiss her and say, "Look, she represents a very narrow little, you know, piece of the party, and she can do her thing." But they're not. They're going out of their way now to do this sort of ritual of purging her from her leadership post. And by the way, she's doing it too. I mean, we talked about this last week. You know, Liz has her own plans here. She's going to run for president, whether it's as an independent or a Republican or whatever. And she's, this is her play to do it. Fine and dandy. And she may actually believe all this stuff she says about Trump. I don't even know, but she's a politician.
Right.
She's her daddy's daughter. And she's not doing this stuff just out of the goodness of her heart or sacrificing herself for no larger purpose. I just don't think that's true. And I think whether or not she'll succeed, it doesn't look like she possibly could, but I can see why she's doing what she's doing. So that's where I think the Republicans are. I think they're getting a lot of what they want. Look at what Ron DeSantis did on Thursday. He signed a bill to dramatically restrict voting rights. He kicked the press out and only allowed Fox News in to do it live. And Florida had a great election, as far as we know, and it went to Donald Trump. I mean, this isn't even a debatable thing. They're just doing it for the sake of doing it.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, this is that it's all this kind of performative stuff that makes you think that this is really not, it's not about any kind of issues or politics. Meanwhile, Biden's just sitting there going out to bridges and standing in front of trains and, you know, trying to pass this bill. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to work for him either.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. There's a lot there that you covered. I think probably you share some of the cynicism that the Republican Party was ever really that engaged in policy. You know, we had that Paul Ryan, and I think I happen to think that one of the big reasons why it took so long for the press to be able to deal with the lies that Donald Trump was saying is because they had muscle memory from excusing the lies of the Republican Party, the really naked ones prior to it. Like, you know, Paul Ryan would get out there and talk about the deficit, and everyone knew that he was lying, right? I mean, every time a Republican is in office, they expand the deficit, they expand the debt. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Per se, I think it's an unhelpful thing to do it via tax cuts as opposed to infrastructure or investment in people that need it down the income spectrum. But the bottom line is they would use this as a mechanism in which to really just to cut things, and the media just lapped it up. I mean, Paul Ryan was like, you know, was like Bono for a while in our political media. And then, of course, the Trump thing quashed him. And so, you know, from my perspective, Liz Cheney and Kevin McCarthy, whoever it is, it's Coke and Pepsi in the same industry. And yes, OK, one has a little bit less sugar. The other one has a little more sugar. And this one has a little bit more of this flavoring, and that has the more. But they're essentially both colas. Let's put it that way. And it's really a branding fight beyond anything else. And so but the pretense is gone. That's
right. That's the difference.
They're not even trying to pretend that it's anything other than allegiance to, I guess, Trump and Trumpism. You mentioned DeSantis. He held up his signing thing almost identically to the way that Trump did. He signed it with not with a pen, but with the same type of
Sharpie
that Trump used. And like you said, it was exclusively done on Fox. He even had a document that I think, you know, that had suspiciously very same color palette as Fox, like the same blues. And I mean, and it is all performative. It is, there is no even attempt to sell policy. And on some level, I think that's very freeing for them because, I mean, it took a while, I think, for them to like, oh, shoot, we can't leverage the debt or the deficit anymore. But then they realize, like, wait a second. We don't have to pretend like we're doing anything. We can just make it about Dr. Seuss. We can make it like Dr. Seuss. That used to be just in the pages of Breitbart. That used to be like the low end discourse. And now it's political discourse for the Republican Party. There's no, the subtext is now the text. And that's it. And the really sad thing for the country is that it is very effective in drawing out their own people, and Democrats have a tough time drawing out their own people when they're not in like some type of like really obvious jeopardy. On the right, I think there's always this, what I call a Masada complex. They are constantly under siege. It's just a question of what they're under siege.
Oh, they love it.
This week it's Dr. Seuss being, you know, is somehow an affront to their whatever it is. And but the left, and I'm saying this broadly speaking, you know, left of center, they don't have that same type of motivation. And everything you said about the structural advantages that Republicans have, I think we have every reason to believe that in 2022, Democrats could very well lose the House, certainly the Senate. And yet, as a segue into sort of where the Democrats are, we got President Joe Manchin out there going like, I'm only doing this with the Republicans. And the leader of the Republican Party saying, 100%, we're not doing it. 100%. And Joe Manchin coming back going like, I don't know. I think he said 70%. Well, he said 100. Well, it sounded like 70. You know, they're both numbers. And that's where Joe Manchin's at. And then Biden comes out on Thursday, I think it was, or Wednesday, and says, look, we got to have pay-fors. I want pay-fors.
Yeah, I heard that.
It is looking a little bit problematic in terms of legislation, at the very least. What's your sense of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. I think we always knew that the first big, you know, bill, the COVID relief bill, was going to be the last one that just kind of went through, and they just, you know, did it because they had the emergency. It was absolutely necessary. I mean, at the time he came into office, the winter surge was still happening and the vaccines had barely started to roll out. So they needed to do that. And I always knew that the rest of it was going to be just pulling teeth unless they could get Manchin and the others, his little coterie of, you know, centrist divas, they could get them on board with abolishing the filibuster, in which case they can pass a lot of stuff. And, you know, we thought for a while that that might happen. I'm not sure it still won't. There's a part of me that still kind of hopes that what's happening is that the administration has said, all right, let's play this out. Let's see if we can get these Republicans on board. Joe, go talk to your friends. Bring them in. Let's see what they've got. Let's see if they're really willing to do it, because we know they're not. I mean, even if Manchin can get one guy, he can get five. He needs 10. There's no way. There are not 10 Republicans. He is living in a dream world. So maybe they just want him to be able to do this dance in public that he really, 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 really tried, and then they'll do it. Now, do I have high hopes that that's either the plan or that if it is, that it will work? No. Because these things never really go that way. You know, it seems like such a good sort of strategy, but I don't think it will actually work. So I don't know what'll happen. I mean, you and I talked about this before. The infrastructure bill has a chance, I think, probably at a much lesser level than what it is needed. The American Families Act, I just don't know. You know, I mean, it's so necessary. It's such a great thing. Maybe they've got a way to try and get this, to try and sell it. Maybe they can get Manchin to go along on reconciliation, because they can maybe push that through reconciliation. But, you know, I just don't know. I mean, I think we're going to watch this over the next few months and just see how this thing develops. But McConnell coming out and saying that, I think that really screws them. Well, I shouldn't say I think it really screws them. It possibly screws them. Because it makes it very hard for Manchin to make this argument. He sounds like an idiot when he's going, well, he didn't really mean that. You know, that's not what he actually was saying. I mean, that's ridiculous. And even Manchin has, you know, some pride that he sounds like an idiot. So, you know, that I think McConnell made a misstep there. He can't help himself.
Did he? I mean, did he make a misstep, or was it? I also wonder if he is just seeing this all go down with Cheney in the House. And he's seeing, we should say that, you know, this week, Trump was denied a return to Facebook on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. And I can't help but think that McConnell's, you know, I'm starting to get the sense from McConnell that what he does is all, not dissimilar to what Trump does, which is if there's a story that is out there that he doesn't want to engage with, and I'm not just even saying on a personal level, I'm saying like that he doesn't think it's good for the Republican Party to engage in, right? Like, it's fine. He doesn't care what happens to Liz Cheney. He doesn't care at all. But what he does care about is maybe what happens to the reporting about Liz Cheney. Does that going to hurt the Republican Party? I think, because like you say, the wise thing would be do is like, let's drag this out. Let's tell Joe Manchin, yeah, or not say in public, yeah, we're not going to deal with them. You know, let's pretend 3 or 4 months that we're going to deal with them and we'll be in a better position. By coming out this early and saying that, it gives Joe Manchin some wiggle room to change his mind and to, you know, to do something that's not bipartisan. I think that McConnell sees like there's a lot of liabilities out there now. And what can I say that is going to project both strength and also be enough of a story that it's going to like even make it hard for my, you know, the morons who follow me to Google it even. You know what I mean? Like even if they knew for it. And I get the feeling that's why he does stuff like this. And then he attempts to make it real. Frankly, right? Like, I don't know if McConnell.
Well, I think he means it, even if he is doing it for tactical reasons. I think he's, you know, that of course he's not going to negotiate.
The real question is like, does he have people on board?
Yeah.
And so I think like he uses that marker as a way of getting people on board on some level. Like,
you know, you may be right that may have been his signal. To, you know, and he said this, we are 100% behind, you know, this. So he said, my entire caucus will vote against all of this, blah, blah, blah. And he wasn't saying we're going to negotiate or maybe we can do it. Just flat out said it. Now, is he talking about Mitt Romney? Is he talking about Susan Collins? I mean, probably. I mean, I don't expect them to vote for anything good. Why would they? But nonetheless, he's foreclosing the idea that there's a group of this, you know, one of these gangs in the middle who are, you know, negotiating in good faith. And that does work for him, you know, but it's just another example, you know, Mitch doing this of just how, you know, basically undemocratic the party has become. I mean, you know, they use every lever of power that they have whenever they have it to, you know, advance their own power. And it's not an agenda. It's not an ideology. It's not anything. I mean, they love their tax cuts, but, you know, whatever. They'll deal with that. But what they really, really want is to maintain their power, stay in there. And if it takes them groveling to the likes of Donald Trump, but that's okay. That's fine. You know, even Mitch McConnell, who came out against him, you know, he's backed off now. He's not groveling to him, but he's certainly not. He's no Liz Cheney, that's for sure. You know, he's using the Trump phenomenon to his own advantage.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. That dynamic, we may actually get something good out of that dynamic. And this may seem a little far afield, but when Facebook refused to have Trump back on, there was a lot of talk. And we saw sort of an op-ed, maybe it was a week or two ago, by Ted Cruz in the Wall Street Journal, something to this effect, like, your woke money is no good here anymore.
Uh-huh.
And it was I think, you know, I mean, Ted Cruz he's playing to this specific sort of new Republican, you know, base, I guess, and the talking point of attacking wokeness. But he also sort of like implicitly, maybe explicitly admitted, like, I used to be your lapdog and I would do anything you would ever say. And now I'm not going to because you're so woke. But in any normal circumstance, I'd be doing everything that you said.
I think he said it outright, didn't he? He said, you know, it would just, if you want us to pick up your phone calls because you want a, some kind of regulation dealt with, don't count on us. Kind of, oh, okay, well, I guess we know now what the arrangement has been. Not that we didn't know, but he just said it right out.
And with Trump being banned from Facebook, we're starting to hear a lot of those same people say, like, maybe it's time for some antitrust. And I'm thinking, like, oh, my God. Yeah. Like, how many times can we ban him again? Like, break up into a million pieces. And then while you're at it, like, can we get Trump, you know, scrubbed from the Google searches? So you break up Google, too. And then you know, we can, when one of them is emerges from the ashes, you know, these five little baby Googles or five little baby Facebooks. Fine, let Donald Trump back on one of them. But so there could be some really interesting things that come out of this, you know, their cult like adoration and to Trump and to Trumpism. I mean, to be fair, right? Like, I mean, they don't, I don't know, they have a personal affinity for Trump. I don't think they do. I think they, you see it in
just, oh, he's a mess.
That thing. I think it's just like they want to be that guy and they think that's the ticket to ride. And it very well may be. I don't think they're going to do it as well as he did, but they're going to have those numbers insofar as the voting things. And we should just mention, I think we're both waiting to see on this one, but, the attorney who had worked out some of the deals for witnesses, you know, relative to Donald Trump and like, you know, people in that orbit came out with a message for Bill Barr that he had lied about, or I should say there's been a FOIA that Bill Barr lied about what the Mueller report was in it and also what he had said to Mueller about restricting his investigations into the Trump org, essentially. And that is something that we will keep an eye on because it's a big deal. It could turn into something. But I'm afraid we are out of time for this week. As always, Heather, a real pleasure. And stay safe. vaccination rates are getting up there. That's a good thing. And hopefully we can get back to some semblance of normalcy over the next couple of months.
Fingers crossed. Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right. Bye-bye.
Has Saudi Arabia's stranglehold over U.S. politics through aggressive lobbying and business relationships begun to loosen, or have their tactics just evolved? Here to break all of that down is Ben Freeman, PhD, director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, whose piece in The Nation is entitled "The Saudi Lobby Moves from K Street to Main Street." Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me, Emma.
So I loved your piece. It's really fascinating in taking us a peek behind the curtain of the Saudi lobbying, I guess, machine. So you begin your piece with a few reasons why it appeared like the Saudi lobby, at least in the traditional sense, maybe dwindling in Washington, the murder of Khashoggi, President Donald Trump losing his election, and throughout 2020 appearing like he would lose the election, and the fight over oil prices as some of the many reasons why it appeared their power, at least on K Street, was diminishing. So can you set the table for us starting there?
Yeah, happy to. And first of all, thank you for saying nice things about the report. When you're writing about the Saudi lobby, you don't make a lot of friends in D.C. Because everybody's on the take from the Saudis in D.C. So it's nice to talk to a friendly audience for once. But what you said was exactly accurate. Basically, coming into 2020, the Saudis are basically looking at their influence in America and wondering where it went. Now, remember, going back to 9/11, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, And yet, did the U.S. distance itself from Saudi Arabia? No, we in fact got a lot closer to Saudi Arabia. And a big reason for that was the Saudis invested hundreds of millions of dollars in influence in America over the next couple of decades after 9/11. And that was kind of holding court in D.C., in the Beltway, up until a few years ago. And it really starts with the Saudi war in Yemen, which is frankly a disaster. It's the U.N. has declared it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And sure, like as Donald Trump would say, there's good and bad folks on both sides. You know, I hate to use that term. The Houthis aren't innocent, but we know from Saudi airstrikes that they're seemingly indiscriminately killing civilians there in Yemen. They've hit a wedding, they hit a school bus, they hit public markets all the time with these airstrikes, and they're using U.S. weapons to do it in many cases. And then fast forward to the blockade of Qatar. And now a lot of people might not know why that was so significant, but from the U.S.'s point of view, the U.S. is allies with both countries. The largest U.S. military base in the Middle East is actually Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. And so when the Saudis suddenly announce, seemingly out of nowhere, that they're going to blockade Qatar, effectively U.S. policymakers go, what about our military base there? You know, they're our ally too. What are you thinking? And ultimately, that didn't go anywhere either. And then you fast forward to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which, of course, everybody in the U.S. is outraged by. Everybody in the world is outraged by, frankly. And then that was the first moment where you really saw the Saudi lobby kind of chipping away. You had several lobbying and public relations firms sever their ties with the Saudis after that. And you really see a sharp decline in Saudi influence after that. So the Saudis are all looking at all this going into 2020, but they're still thinking, like, we're okay, though, because we got this one guy. This one guy just happens to be Donald Trump, and he's living at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And so he vetoes all these bills that Congress has passed to punish the Saudis. But then, of course, 2020 comes around, and it looks more and more like he's going to lose re-election. And so the Saudis made a strategic shift then. They said, we're losing in the Beltway. Looks like Biden could become president. What's our next move? And the move for them was simply, we got to get out of D.C. for a little bit. We got to take this fight to the states. And they did big time.
Right. So that's what your piece explores so thoroughly. And it's incredibly interesting. But I just want to punctuate this point because I don't think enough Americans know about the genocide and the war in Yemen. And I guess we can button up our conversation by talking about where we are now, because the Biden administration has said, oh, we're going to end financial support for the blockade that you reference, right?
Right.
But that's not the whole story. And so the entanglement of the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia goes way further than just financial support for the blockade. But let's move on to what you actually wrote about, which is fascinating. So there's this quiet campaign from Saudi Princess Bandar al-Saud. Is that a correct pronunciation of her name?
That's right.
Okay, so basically they've been mounting this since 2019. I would imagine this was in anticipation of some sort of backlash from the public or just as a plan B, I guess. But making the rounds, trying to present some sort of woke Saudi Arabia to the rest of the country outside of the confines of Washington, D.C. and K Street, which is where they've normally made their influence felt to great effect. And so presenting this thing called Vision 2030. Now, break that down for us, because there's just like Orwellian is overused, but there's a lot of weird Orwellian stuff in what was presented by the Saudis here.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of bad jokes you can make about Vision 2032. And one of them being Vision 2030 should be Vision 21st century and just getting Saudi Arabia to what they should have been doing decades ago. Part of it is economic and, you know, trying to diversify their economy, shift away from just being an oil producing state, an oil exporting state, some financial investments, even some production too, including production of arms that could again be used in conflicts like those in Yemen. So there's a big economic component too, but there is definitely, Emma, you're exactly right. There's a sort of woke component to it as well, or at least the seeming appearance of wokeness, where they're promoting changes to women's rights in Saudi Arabia, greater political freedoms, even doing things like opening up movie theaters and comedy clubs there. It all sort of sounds good on paper. It sounds like a move in the right direction. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that it's very minuscule changes. It's very small things that they're doing, and they're doing it at the same time where they're maintaining some of these old systems of, you know, frankly, political disenfranchisement, infringing on people's freedoms big time. And one of the examples that I like to give folks is, while they're talking about the rights of women to drive, they still have in prison a woman who was fighting for women's rights to drive, Luhani, which is unbelievable to me, because as I'm looking through their lobbyist filings and the propaganda that they're sending around, talking about all the progress they're making about women's rights and women driving in Saudi Arabia, all I can say to myself is, you still have somebody in prison for exactly this thing. So like the hypocrisy to me knows no bounds.
Right. And so, I mean, I'm reminded, honestly, of, not to be too cynical, but the branding exercises that we're seeing post George Floyd by some of these multinational corporations, that, you know, the capitalism is inherent to exploitation in many ways, at least our iteration of it. And some of this stuff that you wrote about, it's the country as a brand, right? Like Saudi Arabia is attempting to brand itself in a certain way, which is deeply dystopian. And so just give us a sense of that branding exercise then, because this is not it would sound business as usual if Vision 2030 was being presented in the halls of Congress or in shadowy back rooms in DC. But these speeches and these presentations are being given in Iowa, they're being given in Maine, they're being given in Alaska. So what is the purpose behind this? What is the strategy?
Right. In some senses, it's actually sort of a simple game plan, in that they'll go into a local community. And by the way, they've done this now in 22 out of the 50 states. This is not an isolated incident. This is a full nationwide roadshow. And the plan really is simple. That they'll go in, they'll talk to some local officials, and this could be anybody from a local mayor, a poison control director in one case. You know, it doesn't have to be some, you know, high up dignitary in state or local government. But they'll talk to local officials and they'll try to get an event organized. Could be at a chamber of commerce, could be at a world affairs council. They've even had events at synagogues, and they're reaching out to the Jewish community too. To host the Saudi ambassador and other Saudi officials. And so they convince these local folks to host these events. And then at the events, they really prime up the local audience and any Saudi connections there might be. You know, it might be one local business that's had some dealings with Saudi Arabia, that's maybe sold some widgets over in Riyadh. So they'll bring that person up to talk about the kingdom. And then they'll, of course, have a long speech from the ambassador or the Saudi spokesperson, too. And everything in it will highlight whatever those local connections are with Saudi Arabia. And they'll promote this what's frankly propaganda about Vision 2030 and all the progress that they're making related to human rights, women's rights, press freedom, all these other issues too. In the poor people in Iowa and other places like this, these aren't issues that they focused on. So their sort of fact-checking meters probably aren't going off, because they're seeing a local official, somebody they probably do respect, talking with a foreign official who's feeding them a lot of what's frankly misinformation. They have no reason not to believe it, so they come away with it believing it. And then what happens on the flip side is that another firm who's working for the Saudis, a firm called Hogan Lobels, they then take the press releases, newspaper clippings from these events that are put on by a different firm, and then they send those press clippings to the members of Congress who represent those districts without saying, oh, by the way, this was put on by a Saudi lobbying firm. They present this like it's an organic event that you know, it just happened. You know, the people in your community, they just organically care so much about Saudi Arabia. They wanted to have this big Chamber of Commerce event with them. And so what we try to point out in the piece that this is effectively astroturfing. They're trying to convince these members of Congress and these senators that there's this kind of grassroots support for a Gulf monarchy, that it's really just all fake at the end of the day.
Grassroots support for a Gulf monarchy. I mean, what an absolutely incredible phrase that is. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will dive into the firms and the institutions that are behind this AstroTurf effort, as you explained. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were talking about how the Saudi government is trying to lobby outside of the confines of Washington at this point and taking it to states like Iowa, states like Maine, South Dakota, I think you also referenced in your piece. And they're doing that through not directly, right? They're not doing it directly from the Saudi government. They're doing it through a separate vehicle, which are these PR firms, including one specifically called Larson Shanahan Slifka, also known as LS2. And this is peculiar because this firm in particular, as you point out in your piece, their work takes place mostly outside of DC, which is not normal for a lot of these very similar firms. And it seems like this abnormality is reflected in the way that they are lobbying on behalf of Saudi Arabia. So take us into that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, frankly, that you have a Midwest-based company representing a Middle East monarchy. But that's exactly what we have with LS2. And frankly, for a lot of folks like me who study lobbying, and I've written multiple reports on the Saudi lobby previously, I was like, LS who? I don't think I know them. They're not one of the players here. So when you dive into them a little more though, they are sort of a bigger player in the Midwest when it comes to public relations and in the so-called flyover states. LS2 actually does have a pretty big presence. They represent a lot of big companies, actually. They've worked with Ford before and other big domestic businesses. And so they have this kind of roster of PR pros with this expertise in reaching some of these state and local outlets that a traditional Saudi lobbying firm who was based on K Street would have no idea how to crack into these places. And so the Saudis hire on LS2 at the end of 2019, sort of reading the tea leaves and seeing that they might need to get this stateside influence going. And so LS2 gets to work really rather quickly and unleashes this sort of astroturfing lobbying blitz on Middle America. And it's frankly, I think it's just as surprising to folks in Middle America as it is to those of us here who study Saudi lobbying in D.C. So in a way, they can sort of get away with something of a surprise attack. And I think, at least from what we're seeing, they've been, relatively effective with it. They keep having meeting after meeting. They're getting the princess in front of a lot of different audiences. The spokesman for the Saudi embassy has spoken on public radio in a lot of communities across the U.S. So they are really effectively able to connect Saudi officials with some of these local communities. I think the real next question is, how is this going to play out in D.C.? Is this sort of bank shot going to work
but
for them?
Really quick before you move past that, just because I wanted to dive a little bit deeper. Yes, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but just the fact that they're targeting local politicians, small businesses, even high school students. Like, I just want to give the audience a sense of how local it is, and then we can turn to how it affects DC, of course.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Great. And thank you for stopping me there. Because frankly, it's ridiculous. And it's also, when you think about lobbying, you know, everybody sort of has this image of like Jack Abramoff, you know, wearing the crazy hat and, roaming the halls of Congress, you know, trying to line the pockets of members of Congress. People don't think of talking to a journalism student at a local high school. They don't think about talking to a poison control officer. They also reached out to the Maine Lobstermen's Union. This is not what you think of when you think of lobbying. But this is what the Saudi lobby is doing right now. They're reaching out to all kinds of local officials. And it's really just, you just name it, every facet of state and local influence, from your state and local senators, you know, to your local beat reporter for your town paper, even to even a high school newspaper. They're contacting just a phenomenal swath of people, and they're sort of sowing the seeds of Saudi influence really, frankly, on just about every street in America.
It's incredible. And so when you mentioned the Maine Lobster example, right, that's an effort to get someone like Susan Collins to be more aggressively in favor of Saudi Arabia, right. and someone like Susan Collins is such a good example for this too, because she tries to present herself as, you know, moderate Republican,
right?
And the images from Yemen and the fact that there is a genocide happening there, she might be particularly susceptible to that given her politics on the Republican side. So I don't know if you could expand on that and just that strategy in particular. This just seems like meant to win over right-wing Democrats, there's no left-wing Republicans, or, you know, not insane Republicans like Susan Collins.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And they're looking at all the past votes that we had on things like arms sales to Saudi Arabia, the Yemen War Powers Resolution, you know, all the punishments that were proposed and passed in Congress that Trump vetoed. They're looking at those, and they're looking at kind of like the middle ground on those votes and trying to see who they could pick off. And so they're going after people like Susan Collins. And if you look at the map of where they're targeting, there's a high correlation with oil producing states, right? You look at the Dakotas, you look at, they're big in Texas, and Alaska as well. And so they're targeting these oil producing states, who, by the way, got very mad at them when they started a price war with Russia earlier in 2020. But they're targeting these folks, and they're targeting these economic ties between Saudi Arabia and these states. And what clearly seems to me like an effort to peel off some more people who might be sympathetic to Saudi Arabia. So it's a very strategic campaign that I think it's yet to be determined if it's going to work or not, though.
Can you expand on the blueprint that they use? LS2 specifically uses, this is the PR firm, to sell Saudi Arabia to the general public. I mean, you write about fireside chats, which is like what you hear from corporate. I mean, say they'll have a fireside chat at a business school or at a, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's such a Zoom era corporate mechanism.
Yeah, no, it totally is. And I think in some ways too, the Zoom era that we now live in, it really helped this campaign, because it allowed the ambassador and the Saudi spokesperson to remain in DC, but still speak to all of these local audiences, you know, hop right on a Zoom with them at a moment's notice, and really increase their reach without having to fly to some of these flyover states. But yeah, they'll do everything from fireside chats. They'll speak at universities. And by the way, a lot of those universities also receive funding from the government of Saudi Arabia too. So Saudi Arabia kind of flies under the radar here as well. They're one of the top foreign donors to U.S. colleges and universities. And the number one donor, in fact, is the Saudis' sort of adversary, Qatar. You hear so much about Chinese influence on campus, but it's really the Gulf monarchies that are driving the train with influence on campus. And the Saudis are taking full advantage of it. And it sort of greases the wheels for LS2 to get speaking engagements on campuses when the Saudi government has already given those universities millions of dollars.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Chinese influence on college campuses, that is purely xenophobia nonsense from the right wing. I mean, because there are, China's an adversary of the United States. Like, they're not talking about Saudi and Qatar or Qatar and their influence there, right? They're talking about it because there are Asian students on campuses and they want to drum up xenophobia. That's me editorializing, but I digress. I just want to turn to the Biden administration because this is a little bit outside the scope of your piece, but we touched on it at the beginning, and I just think it's such an important point to make about the genocide and the war happening in Yemen. So we had this big announcement from the Biden administration that they are going to end the financial support for the blockade there. But as we talked about, the blockade is just one part of it. I mean, the fact that there still is, they said, we will still help Saudi Arabia in their defense, which is very broad, given the complete entanglement that the U.S. has with Saudi Arabia. So to me, that's just so indicative of the dynamic that we've kind of unpacked here about how omnipresent, how ubiquitous Saudi Arabia's influence is in our country, in our government, and how even, you know, if Biden is trending in the right direction, at least the way he perceives it and his administration does, there's limits as to how much they can stand up to Saudi Arabia. I mean, he didn't even formally sanction Mohammed bin Salman after the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi. Right. So can you unpack that a little?
Yeah, I'll start there because that was really a moment for me that was just incredibly frustrating because you finally get this detailed report from the U.S. government that points a finger from Khashoggi's murder directly to Mohammed bin Salman. The report doesn't mince words. It said, you know, this guy knew about it, probably orchestrated it, names, does the whole bit. And so you get that report, then you're like, okay, now we got him. Now we're going to punish him. And then the next thing from the Biden administration is that, well, we're not actually going to punish him. But you just named him in a report. You said he did this bad thing. You're like, no, we're not going to do anything about it. So I think that was incredibly frustrating. All of that said, it's an improvement from Trump, if you ask me, Trump was arguably the real Saudi spokesman in the U.S. For 4 years, you know, pushing for arms sales and forgiving Saudi transgressions at every single point. So it's a low bar that...
And we should add just very quickly, they had a previous business relationship as well, which added another layer on top, like a personal business relationship, not just the longstanding U.S. Saudi business relationship. I digress.
Right. No. I think that's exactly right. And so Biden, there's this incredibly low bar that Biden is coming into. And, you know, he is stepping beyond that. He is putting more pressure on Saudi Arabia. But everything has been sort of, you know, they've been half measures. Like, we'll release the report, but we're not going to punish him. We'll have this rhetoric about, you know, how we're really concerned about the war in Yemen, but then we'll put this caveat on it that it's only going to be about offensive weapons, which I think, frankly, is a redundant term to begin with. You know, all weapons are offensive in some way. So I was very disappointed by that. And so I think it's TBD on Biden. You know, I would give Trump an F when it comes to U.S.-Saudi relations. And, maybe Biden right now is at, you know, a C, you know, maybe a C minus. It's an improvement, but I'd like to see so much more.
Yeah. And it's not even right now. I guess we can give him an incomplete too. But I think it's just, it speaks to how difficult it is for standard politicians who isn't like somebody like a Bernie Sanders or someone who would have theoretically become president to stand up to the Saudi lobby. And I just think your piece in The Nation entitled "The Saudi Lobby Moves from K Street to Main Street" had to plug that a second time because it's so good. You had two co-authors in this piece. I just want to shout them out as well.
Yeah, Brian Steiner and Layla Riazi, the researchers with us. They're fantastic.
Yes. So that it's a great piece. And that's just why I think it hits so close to home, because it's very key and important. So Ben Freeman, PhD, director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to ROFpodcast.com and hear what you've been missing. You become a member, you're getting our bonus material every week. And we're going to add to it too, going in the coming weeks. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, you can check out my daily show, which is co-hosted by my colleague on this program, Emma Vigeland. Every day at noon, we stream live, and then it's later available as a podcast. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. Avenue.